This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on Safer Streets, the Sarah Everard murder. I am joined by Barrister Georgia Lassoff from Red Lion Chambers in London. Georgia is regularly instructed to defend and prosecute a range of offences, including violent and sexual offences. Georgia also provides advice and assistance on a pro bono basis to Women Against Rape, the English Collective of Prostitutes, and has been appointed to the Centre of Women's Justice Legal Reference Panel. Georgia, thank you very much for joining me today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
This is, a really, really sad podcast, actually, for me, because I was just explaining to Georgia before we press record, as we were doing our research, and obviously even before we did our research, the Sarah Everard murder is such a tragic, tragic event. Around 9 p.m. on the evening of 3rd of March 2021, a 33-year-old marketing assistant, Sarah Everard, disappeared after leaving a friend's house near Clapham Common in South London to walk home to the Brixton Hill area. On 10th of March, her remains were discovered in a woodland near Ashford in Kent. On 12th of March, a Metropolitan Police officer with the Parliamentary and Diplomatic Protection Unit, 48-year-old Wayne Cousins, was charged with the kidnapping and murder of Sarah. In the wake of this tragedy, Home Secretary Priti Patel released a statement saying that every woman should feel safe to walk on our streets without fear or harassment or violence. And London Mayor Sadiq Khan said that London streets are not safe for women and girls. I mean, this is a horrific case that I think, Georgia, that has touched the nerve of lots of people, particularly as walking is one of the few activities still allowed during Britain's current coronavirus lockdown. So let's talk about how women can look to try and protect themselves. Is it illegal to carry pepper spray to protect yourself when walking alone on the street?
So, obviously, in the wake of the Sarah Everard murder, there's been all these kinds of questions going around in the media between women and between women on social media about how we can protect ourselves when we're alone walking at night. And a lot of people I've seen and friends of mine have come to me and said, well, can I get pepper spray? I can see I can buy it online. Is that legal? Can I do it? So the short answer is no, it is definitely illegal. So to find out where we find the law for this, we have to go to Section 5 of the Firearms Act 1968. So in the Firearms Act, we see prohibited weapons that you might expect, like guns. When we say firearm, everyone probably imagines like a shotgun or a pistol. But in Section 5, the Act says that devices that discharge a noxious thing, such as electricity, or CS gas or pepper spray, are also prohibited weapons and therefore a firearm. These carry really heavy sentences. The maximum is 10 years in the Crown Court, with the lowest penalty being a fine. So
pepper spray is illegal. You cannot carry it to try and protect yourself. And I mean, I guess it is a really fine line, isn't it? Because, and we'll go on to what happens, you know, if you have protected yourself using pepper spray or in some other form. But it's a really fine line to being able to say to women, here's something that you can carry that you can use to protect yourself that is legal, that can cause harm, and that might save your life, actually. Versus,
Go ahead.
Sorry, Georgia. Versus the law, which, you know, understandably clearly says you can't carry anything that's going to cause anybody else any harm.
Exactly. So with pepper spray, it's illegal to carry, even if you are carrying it for self-defense. And there's no defense of saying, oh, I have a reasonable excuse or a good excuse for carrying it. And we do see that for some kind of other weapons offenses. So, for example, carrying a blade longer than 3 inches is illegal unless you have a good reason for it. So, for example, if you go and buy a crafting knife from a shop and then have to bring it home and you get stopped by the police, you can say, well, I just bought it. It's for cutting vinyl. And that's a good reason for having it. But with pepper spray and other items specifically adapted to hurt someone, there is no defense to carrying it. And as you said, we'll come on to the law of self-defense. But for example, even if a woman was carrying pepper spray and sprayed it in the face of her attacker, it may well be that she wouldn't be guilty of assault because it was self-defense, but she would still have the potential to be charged for carrying that pepper spray under the Firearms Act. Now, whether she would be charged by the police and the prosecution, that's another matter. But in technical legal terms, these items are illegal. Yeah. And it is quite worrying at the moment because we see kind of brands and companies jumping on the back of the Sarah Everard murder by kind of marketing. So, for example, like kitten-shaped knuckle dusters.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, you can buy these on Amazon. And there's been recent cases where women have been carrying them and been charged for carrying an offensive weapon. Just because you can buy it online doesn't mean that it's legal.
Gosh, I mean, and that's another thing, you know, because I think, you know, with Sarah Everard's murder, women are looking at, well, I have to walk down, you know, a high street or any street during dark hours, and how do I protect myself? I mean, Marie Claire reported this week that street harassment already impacts 75% of women in the UK, and currently, you know, national lockdowns only seem to be spurring on more violent and aggressive behaviour. UN Women UK stats this week show a staggering 97% of women aged 18 to 24 have been sexually harassed, while 80% of women of all ages said they've experienced sexual harassment in public spaces. I mean, these are big numbers. This is a harsh reality and it does need to be addressed. But what happens, and we've just touched on it, but what happens if you're attacked? You defend and protect yourself, and you know, whether it's using pepper spray, a knuckle duster, or not using any of those items, and maybe you've just used your own force, and harm comes to your attacker, and then you end up being arrested instead of the perpetrator. I mean, that has to be insane in the eyes of, you know, fairness and correctness. But where do you stand in the eyes of the law?
So it does seem insane from an outside perspective, but unfortunately, and I'll come on to this, it does happen. So the first thing to be aware of is the Code for Crown Prosecutors. Now, this is the test that police and the Crown Prosecution Service have to apply to an incident before they can charge it. So in the situation, we have a woman or a gender non-conforming person who protects themselves against an attacker in self-defense. And unfortunately, they're arrested and the perpetrator is not arrested. So what the police and the Crown Prosecution Service have to do is look at the evidential landscape and then the public interest in prosecuting. So hopefully, such an incident would fail at both stages. So the state would have to look at, do we have enough evidence to prove that this person wasn't acting in self-defense? And if all the surrounding evidence points to, no, this person was acting in self-defense, then therefore the case should fail at the evidential stage and the victim shouldn't be charged. Then even if the police and Crown Prosecution Service say, you know, it's more likely than not that we could prove it wasn't pure self-defense, they also have to look at whether it's in the public interest to prosecute this person. So going into a bit more depth about what self-defense actually is, the jury or the magistrates are going to ask themselves two questions. Was the use of force necessary in the circumstances? So therefore, was there a need to use any force at all? and was the force used reasonable in the circumstances? And this is, these have to be answered on the basis of the facts that the defendant honestly believed them to be. So if you're a woman walking alone at night and a man comes up very, very close behind you, and your honest belief is that you are about to be attacked and you strike out, even if the man says, no, I was just going to ask the time, the court would look at what the woman honestly believed, genuinely believed in.
Well, that's interesting. That's really, really interesting, actually. It's very useful and helpful to know because, you know, I want to look at how does the law protect us with self-defence actions? You know, what does the law provide to women in these situations?
So, taking a step back, that is the law. That is the law from case law and statute. But how it protects women in practice, we see a very, very stark divide. So the Centre of Women's Justice, who we mentioned at the top of the programme, run by groundbreaking hero feminist lawyer Harriet Westrich, they do a lot of work in this area. And sadly, they found a very high number of case studies where a survivor of domestic violence or gender-based violence is charged with an offence while the perpetrator is not charged. So a good example of this is Sally Challen. Well, obviously in Sally Challen's case, she killed her husband, so he couldn't be charged. But looking at this, she was the survivor of years of coercive control abuse by her husband. She was charged and convicted of murder, and 10 years later won an appeal against conviction, where the Court of Appeal allowed the appeal on the basis that she was guilty of manslaughter, a lesser offence, by virtue of her diminished responsibility after the effect of the years and years of abuse on her mental state. So, in theory, the law of self-defence and related concepts like diminished responsibility seem like they should protect women in these situations, but we see time and again that it doesn't. And there's a big deal of difference in the eyes of the law between defending yourself against a stranger on the street where the threat kind of does come out of nowhere, in cases like Sally Challen and Kiranjit Aluwalia, another famous case of a woman who ends up killing her abuser and then charged with their murder. So these cases are much more tricky to deal with under the current law, as objectively speaking, a jury might really struggle to reconcile the elements of self-defense with the actions of that woman, because as we know, we live in a patriarchal gendered society, and we have seen in the past for Sally Challen and Kiranjit Aluwalia, the juries have struggled to see how extreme violence is necessary and reasonable after years and years of abuse.
I mean, it is a very, very, very fine line. And I think that there are not definitive laws, let's say, to say if you are a woman or a man that's just been attacked, or you're being attacked, or you fear that you're going to be attacked, and you cause harm to a potential perpetrator or perpetrator, then the law will protect you. I mean, our Home Secretary, Priti Patel, announced that new laws are being considered to protect women against sexual harassment in public, including the potential of making public harassment a specifically defined crime. And that's something that the charity that you just mentioned, and many other charities and people and women in general, I think, you know, really need to hear and see in practice, because as you say, that there's, was the act of causing harm committed? Yes or no? That's one question that has to be answered. The reasons behind it, there are not laws, definitive laws, you know, that don't say, well, if it was committed to absolutely protect yourself, that you're definitely going to be immune from any criminal conviction. And that's where I think we do need the government to try and assess these laws very, very carefully. I mean, the government's planning safer streets by saying, you know, better lighting, etc., etc. I mean, Clapham Common to Brixton, which is where Sarah Everard was walking, has some of the capital's most populated and brightly lit streets. What do you think about that? What do you think about the government's plans, Georgia?
Exactly. I think the safer streets plan, what is it, $45 million for better lighting and CCTV, I think that's extremely misguided. And as you said, we can see from the case of Sarah Everard that she was walking in a built-up area, there was plenty of lighting, there seems to be plenty of footage of her. So I'm at a loss to kind kind of get my head around how that massive amount of money is actually going to make women safer at all. And the other very, very well publicized plan was to put undercover police officer in clubs and pubs.
Yes. So
this really makes one think that how is a undercover police officer in a brightly lit club going to prevent sexual violence and intimate violence and murder? You know, we don't see this happening on the dance floor. We see these offences happening on the way home, when women share a taxi with someone, when a woman is drunk to the point of unconsciousness and is taken home by a man who then rapes her. How on earth is a streetlight and an undercover cop dancing on a club dance floor going to help? It's just not. And
what do you think would help, Georgia? What do you think? Do you have any indication of what the charities are saying would help? Do you have thoughts about actually this is something that we can try that could very well help? What are your thoughts on that?
So I do have examples, but before I get onto that, I just want to make it extremely clear that the overwhelming messages we're hearing from women at the recent protests are that women do not feel like the police protect them, and that the presence of police does not necessarily make women feel safe. And this is especially true for Black and brown women. I just want to highlight this example. Two Black women, Biba Henry and Nicole Smallman, were murdered in Wembley last summer, and the police who attended the scene took selfies with their dead bodies.
Oh, God.
When we see cases like this...
Goodness.
...and we see the government saying, more police will protect you, we have to understand why women, especially Black and brown women, are saying, really? The police treat us with such contempt. The police do not protect us. And if we look again at the report from the Clapham Common vigil, there was a young woman at that vigil who, on her way, she was walking out of Clapham Common and a man indecently exposed himself to her. She went and told one of the hundreds of police officers there, and the male police officer told her, we're not dealing with that, go away, we're not dealing with that, we're dealing with the rioters, go home. There is so little trust at the moment that it's blindingly obvious to me and a lot of these women's groups why the plan for more police powers is deeply misguided, both on a policy level and a PR level. It's terrible PR. So
what's the answers? What should the government be looking at trying to do? What are the charities, the support groups? What can we suggest?
So there's charities like Sisters Uncut, who are the feminist direct action group who organised the vigil, and other charities like Sister Space and Hackney, who run refuges and campaign groups for women of African descent. What they're saying, basically the women's groups are all saying the same thing. They say provide the funding needed for specialist domestic violence services and rape crisis services to meet the needs of all survivors. Sexual abuse services are in crisis. We have amazing small organisations out there like the Haven centres, which women who are victims of sexual offences are sent to, where they have specialist teams to look after their medical, emotional, and basically all their needs are taken care of at these centres, and they're treated by specialist groups of people. These are far and few between.
Yes, I mean, we've mentioned The Haven in our domestic violence podcast that we've done, but still, we're talking about safer streets. How do we create safer streets for women? The government's saying we're going to create, you know, we're going to spend money and have better lighting. We're going to have undercover cops possibly in place. But what's the answer to try and create safer streets for women?
So, unfortunately, in my view, there's no real legislation that could be put into place to protect women, you know. Street harassment, public order offences are already illegal. Murder, that's a crime. So what we need to do is have a fundamental shift in broader society, which is kind of outside of my speciality, but in terms of the law and the criminal justice system, we have to protect women at every opportunity, from havens to taking women's reports of sexual violence seriously. I mean, if I called the police and reported sexual harassment, I would probably just get laughed at. We need to change the culture in the criminal justice system to respect women, believe women, and take them seriously.
I think
that is really the issue.
Thank you. No, I hear what you're saying. And I think that when also, you know, sexual harassment claims are made, one of the issues that I've read about regularly, actually, that it's often one person's word against another. How do you prove, particularly if a few days have gone past, for example, and there is no evidence on you by way of, you know, swabs that can be taken or anything else? Sorry about that. It was on silent, but my iPhone decides not to go on silent. So it is difficult. But I hear what you're saying. You know, you're saying the criminal justice system has to make provision for women reporting these crimes, and has to sort of take them a little bit more seriously than what women are perhaps feeling like they are being taken at the moment. And then I think that it would probably be incredibly helpful to in another episode, if we cover another episode on this topic, to talk about what are the suggestions, how can streets be made safer, some tips and points that the government could look at considering. Because, you know, you think about it, and I said to you before we started recording this podcast, I actually myself wouldn't walk down a street at night unless it was central London, in terms of Fleet Street, Chancery Lane, or the West End, where there's lots of people buzzing around. I actually wouldn't. I wouldn't feel safe. I've never felt safe doing that, even in my younger years. So what does that say? Does that say I'm not being protected by the country that I live in? Does it say that the government or the police are failing me? Does it say society has to change? We're never going to, I think, eliminate criminal activity. That's just not going to be possible. But how do we make it safer? Georgia, that's all we've got time for.
Thank you so, so much.
Thank you. Thank you ever so much for making the time today. This is a special bonus episode that we've recorded to try and cover and give some information around criminal law, you know, based on this the absolute tragic incident that's taken place. What I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.